I've been away for the past 3 weeks, as some of you might have noticed. I hope you didn't notice, but some of you might have noticed. And the first week I was, first 2 weeks really, I was at our General Assembly, which is a meeting of the ministers in our denomination, and we all get together to do the business of the church. And then after that, I rode around the hot and dirty South, which failed to disappoint, didn't fail to disappoint on either of those fronts, with our daughter, Neve, as we introduced her to her relatives and our close friends. And perhaps the highlight of that trip for me was actually getting to introduce Neve to my father. My father had not met her yet. He'd not been able to fly out. He doesn't really fly. And he also is a man who loves little children. I think he wanted a granddaughter more than Pam and I. I mean, he's been pushing for it since, well, our engagement. Like, that's a little jump in the gun, Dad. And the other thing, though, is that he loves little girls. He just has a special place in his heart for little girls, but he grew up in a house of boys, and I grew up in a house of boys as well. So this is the first girl in the family. And so just to watch him dote over her was really fantastic. And one night, my dad took us out as a celebration for Neve being born, and he took us out to a nice restaurant, and we had a nice meal, and it was a really good meal. It was one of the best meals I've had in a long time, and we got to the end, and of course, we have baby in hand, so that always makes it interesting. People are like, why are you walking to this restaurant with a baby? Because we're paying customers. But then we would, if Neve got upset or unsettled, we would walk back and forth outside and bounce her and that kind of thing. And my dad was going to pick up the car, and he said, if the bill comes, here's the credit card, give that to them and cover the tip. And I said, okay. And the bill arrived, and I had a glance at it. And as I had a glance at it, I thought, wow, that's a pretty expensive meal. It's a pretty penny. And at that moment, I started to feel a little guilty about eating such a nice meal. Have you ever felt like that? We're in the midst of a series, and for whatever reason, I'm the closer, which doesn't make any sense since I brought in the experts before me, on God, creation, and culture, and talking about how those things relate. But if you're like me, there's a certain sense in which we wonder how creation, the creation of and enjoyment of culture, really fit into the Christian life. I mean, is that really a part of the Christian life, or should it be? And perhaps like me, you might feel guilty about that sometimes, or if not guilty, at least you think, well, that's kind of unspiritual. It's something of a distraction. I mean, it takes us away from the main focus of the mission of the Christian life and the church and what it means to follow Jesus. I mean, besides, how can I justify a steak dinner when McDonald's will get me through the night? And how can we justify buying a new piano when there are people on our streets who, let's be honest, are struggling to get food? How can we talk about beautifying our sanctuary when there are other physical and spiritual needs to be met? And yet at the same time, this is kind of the problem, isn't it? Because deep down, we all relish and want to experience and enjoy life. And that means actually experiencing and enjoying the good things of creation and culture. I mean, we can imagine a life without hearing beautiful music. We can imagine a life without tasting good food. We can imagine a life without beholding beautiful dance. But what kind of life is it really? And in fact, I would suggest that this is a major reason that people actually are put off by Christianity. Because we have this idea that if we were to become a Christian, that basically would kill all that. Right? I mean, come to church, follow Jesus. Why? When I want to enjoy my life. And even those of us who are Christians, kind of, this is a big struggle for us. Because the main problem with Christianity that people have is not intellectual. You know that, right? It's experiential. We want to live. And somehow we think that that might not, that Christianity might take away from that experience of life. And so we come to this tension, and we usually feel, if you're like me, that either what it means is that we reject Christianity altogether, or we follow Jesus, but we follow him perhaps half-heartedly, or we follow him and we do what we're supposed to do, what we feel like we're supposed to do, but there's kind of a bitterness and a resentment. Because we're missing out on so much. I mean, it is difficult, and it's not as if the gospel pictures of Jesus really help in some ways, because just think about it like this. What is the shortest verse in the Bible? Jesus wept. Many of us know that verse. Many of us, there have been times in our lives where we were so glad that that verse was in the Bible, that we know that Jesus is a man of compassion and that he wept. But for most of us, there's a verse that we wish was in the Bible. A verse just as short. But it's not there. And that verse is Jesus laughed. Not once in the entire Gospels do any of his biographers record Jesus laughing. And so we wonder, what does a life of joy and enjoying and creating the good gifts of creation, what do those have to do, and how can we reconcile that with following a man who not one of his biographers recorded him laughing? You see the tension. Do you feel the tension? As I feel it. Well, we're going to turn to a familiar story, John 2, and see if it might help us to come up with some answers to this. As we do, let me pray for us. God in heaven, we come to your word, open and submissive, needing to see you. Help us find joy and to rejoice. Make our commitment stronger. Show us your love. For Jesus' sake. Amen. Well, we're going to look at this story, the story of John 2, and we're going to cover it like a good reporter. We're going to look at the who, the what, the when, the why, and the how. The who, the what, the when, the why, and the how. So first, the who. Well, most of you have heard his name. He's the central character, and he's the only named character. His name is Jesus. You've heard that if you've been around here for a little while, because you will know that for us, this man is the most important man that ever lived. That he's, in fact, the greatest man that ever lived. He's the reason that we exist. And though we don't know any of the other characters in the story, I mean, we hear titles like the bridegroom. We hear about the master of the feast. We even hear about the mother, which we know is Mary, but she's not named there. And we wonder, well, who are these people? What are their names? John doesn't give us their names. He gives us one name. It's the only name that we really need to know, and that is Jesus. Because, you see, if you are trying to figure out what Christianity is all about, then you need to start here. With this man, looking at him. And you need to understand why he is so great, the greatest man, in fact, that's ever lived. But of course, those who were following at that time didn't really realize that. This is short in Jesus' ministry. His ministry has only just begun. This is right after he's called five disciples. They believe they've found the Messiah. but really without a lot of justification insofar as Jesus has not done one thing yet to reveal his greatness. But he's got these five disciples, one of whom is named Nathanael, who is from Cana. And there in Cana, Jesus, his five disciples, and his mother are invited to a wedding. Which brings us to the what. What happened at this wedding? Most of you know the story. It's very familiar, but let me provide a recap. You should probably know that weddings in this day weren't like weddings in our day. Weddings in our day are usually an afternoon and evening. In fact, back in my hometown, weddings were so popular and you invited so many people that there were often Saturdays where I would do two weddings in a day. That really doesn't happen in other cultures, particularly like, for instance, in England, where the wedding would start always in the morning, the service, 10, 10:30 or so, and would last well into the evening. It was a day affair. But they topped that in the ancient world. They actually had weddings that were a week long. So they were there for a week. Some of you fathers are thinking, wow, I didn't want to pay for that. Well, good thing the bridegroom had to pay. So I'm glad I live in this culture. But the weddings were a week long, and at some point during the week, at some point it happened. Jesus' mother turns to him and says, they're out of wine. They're out of wine. And after an interesting exchange with Mary, we'll get to that later, Jesus then commands the servants to take six large 20 to 30 gallon stone containers that were used for hand washing, and he tells them to fill them to the brim with water. They fill them up to the brim. Then he says, draw out some of the water, take it to the head waiter. They draw out the water, they take it to the head waiter, but the water had turned to wine. And there we have Jesus's first miracle. He turns water to wine. Now, I know you know the story, but have you considered it? Really considered it? This is Jesus' first miracle. This is his debut. This is his coming out celebration. Here's who I am. Here's what I do. What would you think his first miracle would be? I mean, if you were to write the story of Jesus, what would you record at his first miracle if you were to script it? I would think that if Jesus was coming out, because mind you, miracles are not just naked displays of power. It's pretty cool if it's just a naked display of power. But in verse 11, John says they are signs. That is, they point to something. They point to something about who he is and what he came to do. So if that's the case, then what would I put as Jesus' miracle? Well, I might do something like, you know, show Jesus raising the dead or healing the blind or healing a leper, because then we can show that Jesus came to undo the effects of death and sin. And that would be a fantastic sign for who he was and what he came to do. Or perhaps even I might do something like put in the feeding of the 5,000, where Jesus takes a little boy's loaves and fish and turns them into a feast for a multitude of people who were hungry. And there you can show that, you know, people without food will die. And so Jesus, in the same way, provides your basic needs. But he doesn't record either of those, and he doesn't do either of those first. No, he turns water to wine. He provides wine. Now think about that for a second. I mean, what is wine? Well, while enjoyable, wine is certainly not a necessity. I mean, its nutritional value is minimal. You know, like people say, I'm drinking wine to lower my cholesterol, and we laugh because they could just drink grape juice or something, right? I mean, and yet wine has had a central place in human civilization, hasn't it, from the very beginning. And wine also, it's not a naturally occurring phenomenon. You know, wine doesn't just, you don't just take a bucket to the river and scoop out some wine. You have to actually cultivate something. You take vines and grapes, and through a very long and elaborate process of growth and then maturation, you transform this good of the creation into this elaborate thing. In other words, what wine is the fruit of culture. It takes cultivation. In fact, it has been held a central place in human culture, even up to today. Think of it. How could you talk about the cultures of places like France or Italy without talking about their wine? Wine is culture. And note also that it's kind of a superfluous part of culture. It's not a necessity. We don't need it like cinema or dance or other types of things. People have done and do live without it. I know many of you live without dance. I was at a wedding recently. You live without it. And yet Jesus produces wine. What does this mean? At a traditional wedding service, when you are going to, if you look at the traditional wedding service and the explanation, it usually mentions something about Jesus by his presence at the wedding of Cana, blessing, affirming, and condoning the institution of marriage. And I think that's true. But if that's true, then I also think that what does it say that at this wedding, that for his first miracle, he produces wine, the fruit of human culture? Would that not also say that Jesus at this wedding also affirms, blesses, and condones the creation of human culture and cultural activity? Even things that seem superfluous. There aren't physical needs being met. It doesn't seem that there are basic spiritual needs being met, but yet Jesus uses this. He performs wine. And not just the production of culture, but also the enjoyment of culture. Because did you note that Jesus produces good wine? Look in verses 9 and 10. Jesus tells them to take the wine to the master of the feast, and it says that the master of the feast tasted the wine, and he called to the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." Well, what's going on here? Well, here's what's going on. It's very simple. The way that the people would do it was this. When people's taste buds were the most acute and the most heightened, they would serve really good wine. That is, at the beginning. And then when the people have drunk freely, which is a horrible translation, it's when the people were inebriated or well drunk. That's what the text says. Then they would pour the kind of low barrel wine, the mediocre wine, or the awful wine. Right? That's what they would do then. But he says this, "No, you have saved the good wine until now." But if Jesus has saved the good wine until now, then that means that the wine that Jesus is serving is better than the good wine that they served at the beginning, which means that Jesus' wine is the best. It's exquisite. And he doesn't just make good wine, he makes a lot of wine. There's an abundance of wine. Did you note that? That this wine filled up, if we're to take what it looks like as suggested in the text, is that you've got these six huge canisters or whatever carries of wine. Six of them, 20 to 30 gallons apiece, full to the brim. And that is what Jesus produces of wine. Now, most of us don't buy our wine. If we do, we don't buy it in gallons. We buy it by, you know, the liter, 750 milliliter bottles. And so let me do a translation for you. 800 bottles of wine. That's what Jesus is producing in the small town in Canaan. It is not only good wine, but it's an abundance of wine. Now, let me suggest what I think this does. I think this gives the lie to two ideas. The first is this, The first idea that we kind of have, that many of us have, and that the church can kind of put forward is this, that if you really are following Jesus, you will only be interested in things that meet people's basic physical and spiritual needs. Because Jesus was really only about meeting people's basic physical and spiritual needs. And yet, this text, the first sign that manifests who he is and what he came to do, he did not meet people's basic physical and spiritual needs. Not first and foremost here. It's not to say Jesus didn't do that. It's not to say that doesn't dominate his ministry. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be about that also. We should be about those things. Absolutely. But there is a place here for the creation and enjoyment of culture. And Jesus shows the value in it by creating good wine. And here's what this means. It means that if you're having a celebratory meal, you don't have to feel guilty. It means that it's okay to develop skills in developing things like the culinary arts. It means that it's okay to care about gardening to create beauty. It means that it's okay if you're going into college and you really want to be an art major. It means that that's okay, even though it doesn't seem very practical and you aren't going to make a lot of money when you get out. Because you aren't meeting people's basic needs. Because at the end of the day, people need beauty. Life without beauty is not life. And Jesus comes and he brings this. But it also gives the lie to something else. This story gives the lie to the idea that following Christ means giving up the things that we enjoy in this life so we can just get by and get into the next one. I mean, isn't that how sometimes the church presents and sometimes how we think, if you're like me, about the Christian life? Well, following Jesus just means I'm going to have to give up joy now, but that's better than not going to heaven. It's the worst of two not great options. It's kind of how we feel, because we're like, if that's what it's like here, if that's what God's making me do here, then heaven sounds better than hell, but hey, it can't be that good, right? Because he's taken away everything that's good in this life. That's the way we often think. But this text corrects this picture of Jesus, because even though the gospel writers never record Jesus laughing, they record him bringing an abundance of wine to a party. And you need to remember that in the Jewish mindset, wine meant joy. Psalm 104, verse 15 says that God gives wine that gladdens human hearts. And the rabbis of the time had a saying. They would say, without wine, there is no joy. You see, Jesus, we kind of think of Jesus and it's like he's not the kind of guy that you really want at your party because he's going to kill the party. Jesus is like the ultimate Debbie Downer in a lot of our minds, right? It's like we need him, we like him in certain settings, but we don't want him at the party. Jesus doesn't kill the party. Jesus keeps the party going. The party died. When the wine ran out, the joy ran out. It was awkward. It was going to be over. It was going to end. And everyone was going to leave with a bad taste in their mouths. Pun intended. And then Jesus comes and he says, I'm bringing the joy back. I'm extending the party. And he provides good wine. You see, what Jesus was doing when he did this is he's saying, I came that you might have joy, Jesus says, that you might live, have life. Not just basic life, life to the full, life abundantly. That's John 10. I have said these things to you, Jesus said, so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. John 15. See, when Jesus comes and provides wine, he's saying, I came to make your heart glad. That's why I came. That's why he came. So there's the what. The what. Jesus came to bring wine, and that was a symbol of him bringing joy to our lives. But next we move to the where. I want to consider the setting of the story. I mean, where is it set? I mean, the historical setting is clear. Jesus is at a wedding. But I want to think about that for a second. Jesus is at a wedding that took a week. He has, you know how long Jesus' ministry was, right? 3 years. That's it. 3 years. And he spends a whole week at a wedding. Now, most of you would think, and me, I would think, that's your priorities are out of order. Shouldn't you be moving around? You got 3 years. You need to spread the wealth. Get out there. But he said, no, this is where I'm going to be. I'm going to be present here. If Jesus hadn't gone, the simple fact, if Jesus hadn't gone, if he hadn't accepted the invitation as he was invited to this cultural affair, weddings are a rich cultural affair, if he hadn't taken his time to just be present, then this miracle would have never happened. And I think that suggests at least one pattern to follow is that this, that Jesus is present in the world and present in the cultural affairs of the world. And as Christians, we need to be as well. We need to be present. We need to be there. We can't help. We can't be providing or serving or anything else if we're not there. You know? And so that means that all kind of cultural activity, from things like developing engineering and technology to things like Hollywood and cinema, we need to be present. Jesus said, go into all the world. And yes, that means geographically, but we are also called into every sphere of activity to be faithfully present there. Because if we're not there, if we're absent, what good are we going to be able to do? But I want to note also the literary setting, because this miracle comes in John 2. But this is not the only story in John 2. The first story is this, the miracle of providing wine at the wedding. But then the next story that John provides is the story of Jesus going into a temple, making a whip, and driving people out. You know that story? Some of you heard that story. And the interesting thing about that story is every other gospel writer records that at the end of Jesus' life. And that's where I think that it probably is. Some people think that there are two temple cleansings. I don't. But regardless, even if there are two temple cleansings, John is doing something thematic here because that's the way John works. He likes these contrasts, light and darkness, right? Truth and lie. He likes these kind of things. And here we see this literary context. He was doing something for a very simple reason. Why is he doing this? Well, he's trying to show at least this principle, that Jesus is the kind of guy who takes wine to a party and whips to church. That's the kind of guy he is. In fact, if you look throughout his ministry, that's exactly the kind of guy he is. Jesus reserves his hardest words for who? The religious people. Jesus gives tough love to the religious people, but he gives embracing, warm love to the irreligious people. Welcoming love. And so should we. It's not to say that Jesus condones sin. He doesn't condone sin. Never. But what do we find? We find in the next chapter, John 3, 17, he says that he was sent into the world. His mission, that he was sent into the world not to judge the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. That the Father sent Jesus not to judge or condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. And you know what he says later in this gospel? As the Father sent me, so I'm sending you. That means that the model of Jesus needs to be our model, that we're sent not to judge the world, but that the world might know the salvation of our God. That's a model for cultural engagement. But I wonder if that's how we often act. I mean, you do realize that, right? That is why, that is the model we are to follow. I mean, Paul, the Apostle Paul picks up on this in 1 Corinthians 5. He's writing and there's some sexual immorality going on in the church, and he is giving some pretty harsh words to the church there. Paul's words throughout 1 and 2 Corinthians, Paul's words throughout places like Galatians are pretty harsh for the church. When he speaks to unbelievers in Acts 17, they're actually very winsome. But he says in 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 12, he says, I wrote to you my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. And then he puts this in, not at all meaning the sexually immoral people of this world, or the greedy, or and swindlers, or idolaters. Since then you would have need to go out of the world. What's he saying? I'm not telling you not to associate with sexually immoral people of the world, because then you can't live. But now I am writing you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother if he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed or is an idolater or a vile or drunkard or swindler. Not even to eat with such a one. And then listen to what he says. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? And then he closes with this very important statement. God judges those outside. God judges those outside. It's not our job. And so when we move into the world, this is how we are to relate to it. But it's really the model that we usually follow, is it? I mean, let's be honest. I was speaking to someone just this week, and I asked them for permission to share this with you because I thought that it was said something that was true about my own heart, and maybe a lot of ours, I think. They were talking about how when they go to the supermarket and they see aisles full of the aisle of alcohol in the grocery store, they get so mad because it's by the water, and they want to go through and just start tearing it up, right? Kind of like making a whip, right? Cleansing the aisle. And even when they get into the line to check out, how they feel the need. And sometimes even do tell people, you shouldn't be buying that. And if we haven't said it, then we've thought it, haven't we? And if it's not with alcohol, it's with something else. Because that's the way that we normally act, I think. We normally go into the world in judgment. And we're hard on the world, but we're easy often on the church. You know, we're hard on drunkenness in the world, and we're hard on drunken party. But we're pretty easy on gluttony in the church, aren't we? Often. I don't hear many sermons on it. I don't think I ever have. We're pretty hard on things like homosexuality and such in the culture. But when it comes to hypocrisy in the church, we're pretty easy often. This is not saying that we're to condone sin. Jesus never calls sin something other than it is. But it means that when we move into the world, our job is not to judge it. And when we engage culture, yes, there's going to be plenty of things that are an abuse of God's creation and such. But at the end of the day, we're there to serve and to love. That's not our first thing. Our first thing is not, God did not send us into these places to condemn, but to serve and love. That's the model that Jesus provides here of cultural engagement. Think about the when or the where this occurs. But let's also think about the why. And why did Jesus do it? Why did he provide the wine? Well, at one level, it's very simple. He provided wine because the wine ran out. They were out of wine. And that, of course, I mean, you can imagine would have been a little embarrassing. But something more than embarrassment is going on here. Notice in verse 10 that when the head of the master of ceremonies or the head waiter or whatever he's called, when he goes in verse 10 to speak, he speaks to the bridegroom once he tastes this wine. Why does he speak to the bridegroom? because it was the bridegroom's responsibility to provide the wine. And this was much more than a social faux pas, because you must understand that that we even have examples in this day where if a bridegroom ran out of wine, they were actually prosecuted in court by the wife's parents. I think that's a little harsh. I mean, come on, he just didn't plan well. But here's the logic. The logic is, if you can't provide wine at this party, at your wedding, then you must have been disingenuous about your ability to provide for our daughter. So now I want you to picture yourself as the groom and what he must have been thinking at that point as he runs out of wine, and what everyone would have been thinking. You see, he's not only just a little embarrassed, he is actually in an honor-shame culture. He is dreading a shame that will follow him around. That will follow him around, probably for years. That's the man who isn't able to keep his word. Don't do business with him. And Jesus, in the midst of this man's need, Jesus provides wine. And he says in verse 11, it says that this was a sign that manifested his glory. That's a little interesting, isn't it? It's a sign that manifested his glory, because the fact of the matter is as we see throughout this text, only a small number of people actually know that Jesus did it. Do you note that? This is why he's actually talking to the bridegroom, because he thinks the bridegroom has provided it. That's why he says, you, to the bridegroom, have saved the good wine until now. Jesus doesn't even get the credit. Exactly. That's exactly how Jesus manifests his glory. He gives. He gives to those who are in extreme lack and want, and he gives in such a way where they get the credit. And he doesn't. That is the love of Jesus. That is the gospel. But something deeper is going on here. Something deeper must be going on here when it says that it's a sign that manifests his glory, and then it says that his disciples, his followers, actually believed in him. And to understand what's going on, you need to understand something about the Jewish hopes and heritage. That Jews lived in a story without an ending. And part of that story was that God was going to come and reign. And the way the prophets talked about the reign of God that was coming, the coming reign of God, was always in terms of a massive feast. We heard one of the texts earlier read from the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah 25. It says, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever, and the Lord will wipe away tears from all their faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. And it will be said on that day, behold, this is our God. We have waited for him that he might save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. And this, of course, isn't the only place. In Amos 9, it says, days are coming when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman. That is, that there will be more grapes than you can even take up. And it says, new wine will drip from the mountains and flow from the hills. And in that day, ruined cities will be rebuilt, and they will plant vineyards, and they will drink their wine. You see, when Jesus comes and he provides wine at this party, he's doing more than saying, I come to provide life and life that you can enjoy here and now. He's saying, I have come that you might have abundant life forever. I have come to bring in the ultimate feast. I have come so that your future is not one momentary celebratory event because of the birth of a child, that your whole future is one big celebratory feast. That's why I've come. That's who I am. I am the Lord come to bring this about. But how does he do it? The how. How does he do it? We need to get to the how. Well, he does it simply by speaking his word. I mean, Jesus does no action in this story at all besides speak. He commands the servants, draw the water. That's it. He creates something that would have taken months, maybe years to produce just through speaking a word. And you see that this is no ordinary man. This is the God man. And this is why Mary's advice is so appropriate. Look in verse 5. Do whatever he tells you. Because if this is the God man, then that's the only way to respond to him. Do whatever he tells you. So that brings us to the end. It appears that we've covered the story, except for one small detail. What about that strange exchange with Mary? Did you notice that? It's kind of weird, isn't it? Look in verses 3 and 4. She tells him that the wine has run out. They have no wine, she says. And then Jesus says to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." All right, how many of you eating breakfast this morning or when you were growing up and your mom said something to you, said, "Woman, I have no concern with that right now"? It's a bit strange, isn't it? You wouldn't do that. What's going on here? And this is odd. What's happening? Why this woman? Why speak like this? Such distance. And why this non sequitur? My hour has not yet come. And there's kind of a distance going on here. Jesus is like not all there, right? Jesus, where is your mind? What are you thinking about? Well, I'll tell you what he's thinking about. What we all think about at weddings. You thought about it every wedding you've ever been to. And that's your own wedding. The one that you had. The one that you wish you would have. The one you had hoped to have. We all, when we're at a wedding, think about weddings. And I suggest to you that Jesus is no different. Because throughout the Bible, God is declared, the relationship between God and his people is described as a bride to a bridegroom. That God is our bridegroom. I mean, think about it. It's in Isaiah 62 or Jeremiah 2, Joel 1, the whole book of Hosea, but especially chapter 3. But Jesus takes this image and applies it to himself. You see, he sees himself as the bridegroom. And throughout the Gospels, he talks about himself as the bridegroom. Luke 5, Matthew 9, Mark 2. Or just flip over one chapter. Flip over one chapter with me to John chapter 3. John is explaining who he is in relationship to Jesus. And there in John chapter 3, verse 29, John says, "The one who is the bride, the one who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom," speaking of himself, "stands and hears him, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is complete." John is saying, "I rejoice greatly. I am the friend of the bridegroom." But who is the bridegroom? It's Jesus. You see, Jesus is thinking about his own wedding. And he's thinking about the fact that he will have to one day provide wine. Well, how's he going to do that? And what is this about him saying, "My hour has not yet come"? You see, throughout John's gospel, this word "hour" or "time," as it might be translated, is a very important term. It actually divides the whole gospel thematically. John structures his whole gospel around this hour. Listen to some important verses where he talks about this. In John 12:23, "And Jesus answered him, 'The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. 12:27. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come, Jesus says. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Or then in 13:1, now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that the hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. What is the hour? In John, the hour is the hour of Jesus' glorification. But that hour starts when Jesus is glorified by being lifted up on a tree, climbing a cross, and dying for the sins of the world. The reason Jesus says, my hour has not yet come, is because it did not cost much. It did not take much for Jesus to provide wine at that wedding of Cana on that day. He could simply speak the word. But it cost a great deal for Jesus to provide the wine of the feast that would last forever. The wine of what this, the feast of which this wedding would only point to. It would cost a great deal. For then he would not simply speak the word in power, but he would cry in anguish, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is how Jesus provides for the feast. This is why he is distracted. This is why he is taken up. In the midst of everyone else's joy, he knows that he has to face a moment where he will have to pay dear to provide for his bride. It was a strange night, I'm sure, when Martine and Philippa received that unwelcome guest from Paris. A refugee, she had come because there was a fight and bloodshed in Paris and she needed to escape. She came with a letter telling these two girls, named by their father who was a pastor after Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon, pastor names, we do that. Pam thankfully vetoed mine, Calvinia, that didn't work. These two pastors' daughters received this woman named Babette into their household. And for some 15 years, she served them there in that little pious community off the western coast of Denmark. Some of you know the story. You've read the book or you have seen the movie. I recommend it to you. Unless you only watch Vin Diesel movies, then you will not like it. But it's an amazing film about this woman who comes in and serves this community who is taken up with bickering and strife and relational disharmony. And after some time, she says, I would like to prepare a meal, a real French meal for you. And so they say, okay, but they're a bit scared because she's Catholic and, you know, she might even be worse being like, witch gods and stuff, and then they see this half of a cat, like a kids, the heads of a calf cut off in the kitchen, and they're wondering what they're getting themselves into. So they decide to make a pact that they'll all go in and they won't say anything, and they'll be very austere at the meal. Except there's one guest who didn't get the memo, and he's actually been to Paris and tastes French food. And so throughout the meal, as she's serving this exquisite meal, he just starts saying, "This is amazing. This is so enjoyable. Oh, surely this is good." And then finally they get to this one course and he says, "There's only one place in the world that serves this course this well. It's a cafe in Paris. And imagine this, the chef is a woman." And at that point her identity, Babette's identity, was revealed. That she in fact was the best chef in Paris. And that she then decided that I will give this feast to these people that they might, and through this meal you see them start opening up to one another in reconciling love. And there's this great statement that the lieutenant makes, quoting actually a favorite verse of their fathers, the two Lutheran pastor daughters' fathers, where he says, mercy and truth have met together, righteousness and bliss. Kiss one another. Now what Babette did within that moment is she took holiness, righteousness, piety, and she made it wed, kiss, with the enjoyment of God's good creation. After the supper was over, the girls spoke to her, and they found out that she had actually won this lottery ticket worth like something like 10,000 francs. It was what could get her back to France and what could actually start her life at that time anew and restore it. And they asked her if she was going to go, and she goes, no, the money has been all spent, you see. A meal at that cafe in Paris for six people who were at the table, or 12 or whatever it was, well, that would be 10,000 francs that she spent at great cost to her, this enormous price, this amazing sacrifice, so that these people might experience righteousness and bliss, joy, kissing one another. Jesus comes into this party. Jesus comes into this world. Jesus comes to say, I've come to make righteousness and joy, bliss, kiss one another. Not only now, but forever. At great cost to myself. But at great, great, great love for you. Let's pray. And Father, we do ask that we would look at Jesus, that we would know his love, that we would rejoice in his grace. It's in his name that we do pray. Amen.